The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. This is part two of the Chuck Klosterman podcast. I think it's the first time we've ever had to split up one podcast taping into two podcasts, mainly because it was too long. It went for like an hour and a half, and that is just too long for anybody. So what we did was we ran part one. That was like 35 minutes yesterday, and that was about college basketball and pro basketball. This particular edition is about newspapers versus the internet, which is a topic that just came up in the podcast, and we ended up going for 50 minutes about it. It gets a little heated at times. It was fun, though. I enjoyed it. It was about time we took the gloves off in a podcast. So here's the continuation, part two, me and Chuck Klosterman on the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now. You know, that's one of the things I want to ask you about. The newspapers in general are just, you know, like the people are saying now the Boston Globe might be done in a year. I grew up dreaming of writing for the Boston Globe, and now that paper's probably not going to exist by the time my kids turn 8 or 9. I mean, it's just crazy to me. What, in your opinion, what did newspapers do wrong, or was this just a natural thing that was meant to happen?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing was Craigslist and classified ads. That is by far the biggest factor because it, looking for a car, looking for an apartment, it's just easier on the internet and it's free. So all basic, that revenue that newspapers were able to generate basically just by having sections of classifieds was gone.
Right.
And, you know, it's, when you take away that money, I mean, news gathering is very expensive. I mean, particularly if you're a large operation that you want to send people places and that you're going to have to invest money on stories that might fall through. If you start removing those things, if you start removing those extra expenditures because you can't afford them, then there's nothing in the paper that is valuable. I mean, it's not as though people are reading the newspaper less. They're holding newspapers less. They're reading the stories more. If you write a story for the New York Times now, the odds that like 4 or 5 times the circulation of the New York Times will read that is much greater than it's ever been. It's just that the stories have no value.
Yeah. I've been thinking about writing this forever because it's just like the Globe thing is just so hard for me to fathom that this paper that was just an essential part of everybody's life when I was growing up there is now is no longer going to exist soon. And I do think that's definitely the ad thing is one thing. I also think, well, there's two other reasons, but the first one, I just think they totally screwed up this internet thing from the get-go. You know, because it's something that was sitting there in 96, 97, 98, 99, and I was on the internet at the time, wondering why they weren't doing anything about the internet. And their attitude about it was just so, like, they were so above it. It was, you know, I remember, like, when I was working at Digital City Boston, and they were paying these four guys from the Boston Herald to write basically sports columns for Digital City Boston. They were paying these, like one of these guys made more like in a week than I was making in a month for them. So you could imagine all four. And these guys mailed it in. Like they were writing 500 word columns. Like they didn't care. They didn't think anybody was going to read it. They were just happy to get a paycheck. And meanwhile, I'm like killing myself. And eventually Digital City Boston realized, why not? We'll just give all of their money to him. But that was kind of the mentality back then. Like, oh, it's the internet. Who cares? And by the time they kind of realized, oh, crap, we got to do something here, you know, they kind of missed this whole window. It's amazing when you look back at it.
Well, I mean, technology moves faster and evolves faster than people do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the technology has changed much more rapidly than even the understanding of it by, I think, people who were even to a degree on the inside. I mean, what should they have done in your mind, though?
Well, I knew.
In retrospect, what they should have done, well, they can't do it now because it would be collusion. But if they, you know, if they could go back in time, what they would have done is every newspaper would have immediately charged for their online content the exact same price the newspaper was.
Yes.
Because if they would have done that initially, people would have been like, oh, the paper's 50 cents at the store, or I guess they can get it 50 cents at home. You know, and that wouldn't have been as jarring. They made the mistake of trying to be what the pre-existing internet was, which is that
right.
Information longs to be free. So they just put all the information out there, and it was great for the consumer. And at this point, it's still good for the consumer. But when these newspapers begin to fall, it's going to be really problematic because the information that people are getting for free now will not exist. There will be no one generating it, and it will just sort of be commentary.
I think the biggest problem that they were scared of the immediacy of it. Cause I remember the exact day, the first time I thought the internet might beat newspapers was the day the Red Sox traded for Pedro Martinez. And which was either 97 or 98, I can't remember. 97. November 97. So it happened in the morning. And I remember I wrote a column and it went up at like 3 o'clock East Coast time. And then we had like, you know, people could react to it and leading the AOL part of the website with it. And the newspaper story didn't go up for like a full, you know, 16, 17 hours later.
But as you're saying that, Bill, when you think about it, doesn't it sort of seem crazy that that became normative? I mean, it's not like 9/11. It's not like Columbine. There was nothing about that story that was important to be read by people immediately. But the fact that we decided, kind of as a culture, that, you know, information about the new Hold Steady single or information about any NBA trade or the release date of a movie coming out next summer needs to instantaneously be consumed for it to be valid. I mean, that sort of puts every technology besides the internet in this really, like, problematic position.
Well,
it doesn't really matter what they're offering. The main thing that makes something important is newness, and that's culturally bad.
Well, you're arguing something different, though.
Because you're saying that the newspaper had a real problem with the immediacy of it. And now, from a newspaper perspective, they viewed themselves, any daily newspaper, any reporter, would have thought, certainly in, say, 1992, would have viewed themselves as an immediate news source. That I'm going out every day, I'm finding news, and by tomorrow morning it's going to be out. It's not like a book or a magazine that takes time. Not like I need to have cameramen and producers and make a bit that will, you know, air 3 days later. We're immediate. So then there was this new medium that was even more immediate, that people could basically write things instantaneously, and no one really factored in how relevant the information itself was. Does information like news about a trade need to be consumed by fans the day it happens? Is there any downside to it being a day later?
Here's the thing. It was already in place because the talk radio, we had an all sports talk radio station at that point in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So the trade happens in the morning. They talk about it for the whole day. The newspapers were fine with this arrangement because the previous arrangement was, okay, if people want to react to this or listen to people's reactions right now, they'll go to the WEI, the all sports radio station. And then tomorrow, we'll come in with our well-reported, well-thought-out angles on the story.
Mm-hmm.
The internet comes in. The internet now is basically beating the newspapers to the punch with stuff that, for the most part, wasn't as well written or well reported. But the newspapers totally overreact and they're, oh my God, we're getting killed in the immediacy. For some reason, it bothered them that this written stuff on the internet was immediate, but it didn't bother them that the radio stations was immediate. Does that make sense?
Well, because the mediums were more different.
Yeah, no, I know.
I mean, in talk radio was, you know, I mean, in some ways, the closest analogy to what the internet is actually is like talk radio. I mean, certainly sports blogs now are more like, I mean, the big ones are sort of like a version of what the Jim Rome show would have been like in
right.
98 or 99, where someone just takes an item of news and says something funny about it to varying degrees of success, and then they sort of rely on all these clones to respond.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that's sort of what it's like, okay? But it is different in the sense that that's one part of the internet, but another part of the internet is taking away the revenue outlets as well, like Craigslist and stuff. So people in the newspaper industry tend to view all aspects of the internet under the same umbrella.
But they were wrong.
They are wrong. That's true. They're different things.
Because here's how they should have won. They should have just won by actually continuing to do what they were doing, which was to out-report people and write better stories. And instead they were like, no, let's get stuff right. No, it doesn't matter if it's free. We got to get it up. And they inadvertently gave away their product for nothing. See, why would anybody buy a newspaper now?
If somebody asked me, like, you know, why did the internet kill newspapers, I would say it really started with the way newspapers reacted to television. Television was new. They saw this sort of as that was their adversary, right? The electronic media in general. And what they could have done is they could have went the other way. They could have said, okay, CBS is able to show us images of Vietnam right now, but let's go the other way and actually write longer and actually put more effort into things that cannot be captured through, you know, television. But they went the other way. They tried to make the newspaper more like television, which is why we saw things like USA Today emerge and all those things.
Right.
Newspaper design during the 70s and 80s definitely moved closer to TV. So then when the internet came in, that was just their model. It's like, we try to compete on these things on their terms, and they couldn't compete with this.
And it's a terrible job, and I was saying at the time, because, you know, I was in on the internet pretty early, and I kind of knew a little bit about how money was made and money was not made. And they were like, oh, yeah, all the money's going to be in the internet. And it was like, I actually don't think that's correct. Nobody really knew how to monetize the internet at that point.
But no one does yet.
Yeah, well, they have a better idea now, but it's still not, you know, I think streaming videos helped and that kind of stuff. But still, yeah, you're right. I mean, nobody solved the puzzle yet. But back then, nobody had any idea. And it was crazy. And it was just, they overreacted so badly. For instance, if I say to you, we can go out to dinner tonight at Ruth Chris Steakhouse and it'll cost $50, or we can get delivered and it won't cost anything. Obviously, you're just going to come over to my house and we're going to eat the steak there.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we go to the steakhouse?
Exactly.
And that was what newspapers did. They're like, yeah, buy our newspaper or just read it for free on the internet.
Well, I mean, they were convinced that you have to do that to compete, that you had you were not a competitive news source unless you had a website like everyone else did.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's just how it goes. I mean, you know, everybody wants to sort of bemoan the death of newspapers. It's a very romantic thing sort of to take, you know, I see polls now where people will be, the question will be, do you prefer reading newspapers at home or on the internet? And the people saying that they preferred at home is like 88%. They dominate these polls. But in truth, you know, how central was it to people's lives beyond tradition? It felt like something that their family always did. They remembered reading the newspaper. They sort of have this view of what it's supposed to mean to someone's life. How much information were you really getting from it?
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder, you know.
I think it means more to people like my dad, who just, it's so ingrained in them that they wake up and they have coffee and they read the newspaper. And that's just how they wake up in the morning. So for them, the concept of waking up in the morning and it's having coffee, but going online instead of reading the newspaper is just too weird for them. And it will always be weird.
What he cares about is the experience much more than the content.
He likes having the paper.
So when we argue about it or talk about how newspapers how they should improve or they need to save themselves, we always kind of focus on the content, when really maybe the main thing about it was the experience.
Well, there's a third factor that nobody ever mentions, ever, when they talk about this. They talk about the same two things we just talked about, but they never mention the third part. And I am very pro-union in general, but I think with newspapers, the unions, out of anything, played the biggest role in kind of killing the whole newspaper thing. Because all it did was allow people to basically decide, do I want to mail in my job or not? And a lot of people did. And it, also, if you made a bad hire, you can never get out of it.
All that's true, but you're overstepping or overlooking the most important thing, though. The main thing it did, though, is raise the floor for salaries. I mean, when I was working in Fargo, it was not a unionized paper. I was making $24,000, I think, at the peak. I had a friend who was designing the Kansas City Star that was also not unionized. I think he was making $29,000. I went to the Akron Beacon Journal, which had a very strong union, and I believe I started at $51,000. Now,
that was pre-internet, though.
Well, but I'm saying that was because of the union, though. I mean, if the union wasn't there, they would not have paid $51,000.
I'm with you with the whole union thing up through the late 90s.
Well, you said it was the primary problem.
Yeah, because and here's why it's a problem. Because once newspapers needed to get better to combat a lot of the stuff the internet was doing, they couldn't. And we've seen it happen in sports sections in every newspaper in the country. None of these guys have a sports columnist under 40. Basically, the sports columnists leave the newspapers to go write for the internet because it's more money. The internet doesn't have unions. I mean, it's basically the best people survive.
Not the best people, though, the people who get the most attention. Those things aren't always the same.
No. I'm talking about writers, editors, publishers, anything.
It's like, I do think it's crazy when people try to argue that the internet somehow is more of a meritocracy. That's totally untrue.
Why is it untrue?
Well, it's untrue for a couple of reasons. First of all, would your readership go up or go down if you were allowed to put full nudity on your column? I guarantee it would go up. Now, does that mean that the quality would improve? That's a kind of merit, but it's not a meritocracy. If you were able to swear in your column all the time, you would get, at least initially, much more readers. But that would mean the quality improved. I mean, the thing is, it does reward, it does have a kind of built-in star system. But the sites that are most successful are not the best sites. I think that seems kind of obvious to anyone who looks at the internet, isn't it?
Yeah, but I still think that on the internet, if you're not doing a good job, your contract is not renewed. In newspapers...
But what do you constitute doing a good job? What you're saying is that if your readership goes down...
But
that's not the case if you were, say, a newspaper columnist. And let's say you consistently attacked a corrupt mayor, and everybody in town didn't believe you because they thought the mayor was great. Your popularity continued to go down. You kept reporting on this. You wouldn't lose your job for that. In fact, eventually, if the corruption proved to be true, you would be rewarded. That would not be the case in the internet, where if you lost eyes, you lose your job. So it is a meritocracy, but only in the sense of pure capitalism. That's the only thing on the internet that is objective.
But isn't that what the newspapers fundamentally are a business?
They are fundamentally a business, but the problem with it, I mean, everything that if you're selling a product, there's a business capacity. But maybe I was fortunate in this, I don't know. I never had a situation in the years I worked at newspapers where something I wrote or what I was told to write about or cover was dictated by advertising, that there was an emphasis that we needed to cover something, because if we covered something in a certain way, it might be problematic, and if we write negative things about Britney Spears, she won't appear on our cover of our weekend magazine. That never happened, okay? I mean, there was a time when it does seem like the separation between the economic side and the editorial side was pretty important. Now, that got less and less over time, but now I feel like there's none on the internet.
Well, if you liked newspapers so much, why did you leave newspapers?
Well, I got a better job.
There you go. You're the perfect example. You left newspapers
because
newspapers couldn't keep people like you.
Well, I wanted to live in New York. I wanted to go into magazine writing.
Because it's a better job.
But so you're saying that the newspapers failed because the jobs weren't good enough? How come we still have garbage men? That's not a great job, but
newspapers failed because all the people who would have helped them sell newspapers decided, you know what, I'm going to do this instead. And
so
they went to the internet or they went to magazines.
Your argument would have been like, if a newspaper has someone who's going to go to magazines, they should just throw money at them to keep them.
I'm asking you, a newspaper is a business. If you don't have anybody writing for you that is going to sell newspapers and make people more likely to buy them, then you're failing as a business.
So you're not that interested in journalism, then?
I am interested in journalism.
Because what you're saying is that you need people to write who sell papers, and that's kind of what the role that a lot of columnists serve.
But quality people sell newspapers, whether they're columnists or whether they're feature writers or reporters or whatever. The Boston Globe, when I was growing up, their reporters were Bob Ryan, Lee Motville, Peter Gammons was doing baseball for them, and Will McDonough was doing football. All of them left except for Bob Ryan because there was more money in TV or magazines or whatever. All of them left. That tells me that newspapers, they weren't cutting it for whatever reason.
That's a strange argument. So you're saying that their inability to hold their best people, that they should have just paid them whatever it took to keep them.
I'm saying that newspapers...
I feel if that would have been the case, newspapers would have folded earlier.
They wouldn't have, but they wouldn't have... No, you twisted my thing around. Newspapers were very comfortable because they were like, you know what, we can do this. we can put out this product. People are going to buy it.
We have guaranteed readership. That's
we don't have to worry about it. So with unions and stuff, they're thinking, yeah, fine. We have unions. Your jobs are protected. We don't, your performance, if you want to start mailing it in, that's fine. You have a union job. But once the internet kind of changed the equation to them, they really couldn't adapt to it. And they didn't really have the firepower to kind of fight back, in my opinion. I mean, I read the Boston Globe now. It takes me 2 minutes.
Well, you know, and also one thing that, was the problem, you know, we're talking about this immediacy. I mean, you know, it was hard to truly be immediate at a newspaper because there were certain, like, rules you had to follow. Now, it would have been interesting, what if newspapers had removed those rules? You know, like, let's say at a lot of places there was the idea, say this thing about this trade you had alluded to earlier.
The Pedro trade?
Yeah. That was big news you were talking about. Okay. How many sources did you get that from? Because there's a lot of places now where one source would be enough. There, for a long time in newspapers, it was never that way. One source would not be enough.
No, it was an announced trade. It was like, hey, the Red Sox have acquired Pedro Martinez.
Oh, so you were just reacting to the news.
It was like, hey, this is cool. Pedro's good. This is good for us. It was one of those type of columns. Yeah, I'm not saying it was going to win a Pulitzer Prize, but it was a reaction. It was a written reaction that was relatively coherent, that was 18 hours ahead of what the newspapers were able to do. And that's when I kind of felt, this is interesting. At the same time, you know, one of the reasons I left the Boston Herald was because I just looked at the landscape and I thought, holy crap, like I'm going to be 35 and I might have a chance to cover the Bruins. Like, that's my best case there right now because nobody ahead of me is going to leave.
That was probably the case. That was probably true.
But is that a good thing that if somebody like me, who obviously, I had some talent, that I left because I knew I was never going to get a chance until I was 35 to freaking hang out in the Bruins locker room and get quotes from Ray Bourque?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess that what not I, but other people would say is that during those 13 years when you weren't the lead guy, you would have been acquiring other skills that would have paid off later, that you would have been making contacts and developing an understanding that you might not have when you're a young person. I mean, certainly, I think you would agree. Like, are you better suited now to write about the NBA than you were 5 years ago? I would say you're much better suited.
I would say the skills that you would claim that I should be acquiring, I'm not sure those guys were working that hard at acquiring.
If they're necessarily skills, but let's talk about your column about the economic state of the NBA. There was a lot of material in there from unnamed but clearly authentic sources that gave you real information about what was happening. Okay.
Yes.
Could you have gotten that information 5 years ago?
No, because
you haven't. Just because it's just time. It's just time,
yeah,
Bill. Because
it became more visible. But here's the flip side. So when I was at the Herald, like I was at the Herald from 93 to 96, so we had guys who, like there's a guy who's the Patriots beat writer. That's a 5-month job. You're paying this guy a full salary to do a 5-month job. Now you have guys, like the way the Herald works now, because there's a much smaller staff, and they have a guy named John Tomasi who covers the Patriots, but then also does the Red Sox.
For 4 months of the year, he probably works 6 or 7 days a week, probably 14 hours a day. He covers the combine.
14 hours a day? What are you talking about?
Well, when you factor in, it depends how aggressively he did his job.
None of them were doing it aggressively. I was there. I'm not just talking about the Herald. I'm talking about any newspaper. I mean, really, like, I just feel like it was like kind of a, it was almost like becoming a tenured professor. You get tenure. Now it's up to you for how you want to handle the rest of your career. Do you want to handle it totally professionally, a little bit professionally, or whatever? And a lot of these guys are like, hey, I'm in. I get it.
Okay, but tell me, okay, let's just, to a degree, this is just kind of a hypothetical. To what degree should, say, your employer, ESPN, how willing should they be? What if someone contacts them and says, hey, you got two guys writing columns on your front page, and they're both bad. I'm better right now. And he starts turning in material. Do you think that, like, how if the young version of you, you know, Bob Simons, this young 23-year-old writer who has, you know, he's from Seattle and he loves the Seahawks and he bemoans the loss of the Sonics and he has all these thoughts on the Mariners and he has this huge following in Seattle and he's like, would you say, like, well, okay, put him up, let's compete? Should they just put up everybody? How is it different? How is someone getting in your position any different than the position Bob Ryan got into?
But I'm not in a position. We have like 45,000
Than Bob Ryan ever was.
Yeah, but
we have a bigger audience for more money. You can write about whatever you want. You have more.
But here's the difference.
Travel less.
Here's the difference. There's 45,000 other columnists on ESPN.com. I mean, have you been to ESPN.com?
Yes.
Everyone has a column.
I know, but up front, there's only two. Up front, there are two. There are two people who are the featured guys on ESPN.
Yeah, but that didn't happen until a year and a half ago. I mean, I'm talking about five and a half years where...
Come on, man.
It's true.
You have been on the front. Everything you write has been featured immediately for years, and I think it should be. But what I'm saying is that it's really interesting that you seem to be arguing that these 35-year-old guys you remember, you felt had sort of fallen in this position like a tenured professor. You're more like a tenured sports professor than probably any sports writer who's ever lived, in the sense that you're in this position basically to just kind of create your own world. We even call it the sports guy's world, where you kind of create this whole world where you get to write, you get to use your own language, you get to make up these things like the Ewing rule and stuff, you get to kind of have this whole sort of counter-reality that's just yours. How could someone else get that? They couldn't. You are more insulated.
Like,
you're more isolated and more insulated than Bob Ryan or Will McDonough or Bill Paschke or any of those guys.
You're totally wrong because, for instance, the Globe has had two columnists, sometimes three, since 1989. Two of them have not changed. Right now the columnists are Bob Ryan and Dan Shaughnessy. Those guys have been the columnists since 1988.
It would be easier for someone to become a Metro sports columnist than to have your position at ESPN.
I only write once a week.
But you could write five times a week if you wanted to. You could write once a month if you wanted to. True or false?
Yeah, but I don't understand what your argument is.
Well, what your argument is that the problem with newspapers, you said, is it almost became like, because of the unions you're claiming, it became this galvanized situation where people would get in a position and they would never vacate it. And that you left because you were sort of like, I'm not going to wait 15 years to become a Bob Ryan type personality. There's no way I can usurp him. He's in this position forever, regardless of the work he does. But that happens everywhere, regardless of the system that's happened at ESPN. That's going to happen in the blogosphere. At some point, the primary sites in the blogosphere that have the most degree of influence are just going to become that, regardless of their content. You can see this with a lot of sports blogs already that are big. That the quality is not as high, but it doesn't really matter. The traffic still goes up. What I'm saying is the thing you're complaining about has happened in your life one time against you and then again to your benefit.
But it's not to my benefit because...
How is it not to your benefit?
Because ESPN.com, we have like 100 columnists. I don't think I have like an entrenched position versus anyone else
like
other than that I have a box.
You kind of feel like your column is lost among the flotsam and jetsam of ESPN. I don't think that happened, Bill. I don't think that's the case.
I definitely think it was the case the first 5 years. I think it was the case the first 5 years. I earned whatever box they gave me by just writing stuff that people read.
So you're saying that you put in 5 years of work to get in the position you are now. That seems like a valid amount of work for one to get that position, right? I mean, the position is not valuable if anybody can get it.
But why did they give me the box?
Well, okay, why would they give you the box? Because you're the most recognizable personality on ESPN.com by far.
But
you have the highest readership.
I think it goes beyond that, though, because part of the reason is if you have somebody searching for somebody's columns, you want to make it easier for them just to find the person, right?
Okay.
So that is why you put somebody on the main page in a position where they no longer have to search, they can just find them.
So just go on the record here. Are you arguing that you feel ESPN does not feature your column enough?
I didn't say that.
Or that somehow it's difficult to find?
I never said that. I think it was for a while. I think it was really hard, and it was one of the reasons I fought for them to potentially put a box up there. Because I felt like, why do we have all these people searching for it when... You could just put something on the main page. I didn't get it.
Do you feel they do a good job of promoting you? I see commercials now with your name on the commercial. It would seem like that you're the only columnist I can think of who's on a TV commercial.
Well, Matthew Berry's going to be in one.
What?
He is. There's a lot of people. It's like the whole ESPN.com campaign. There's going to be a lot of people on it.
Oh, that's good, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not in any way implying that you do not deserve this position. You do.
You're kind of implying a little bit.
No, what I'm saying is it's just interesting how different your perspective is as a 37-year-old guy.
But here's the difference.
Compared to the way you describe it as a 23-year-old guy, even though you seem to be talking about identical circumstances.
It's not identical. You know why? Because
why?
If I started mailing in columns and not giving a crap, they wouldn't renew my contract. I'd be out. That's why I still give a crap.
So
fundamentally, it's in my interest to keep caring, and that's why I keep busting my butt on everything I write. Whereas if I'm in a newspaper and I'm a columnist, and you can go around the internet and
meet a lot of these people, I don't have to care anymore once I get the job. Let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Okay.
Okay. You recently wrote a column that wasn't about sports at all. It was about actors and actresses. It was basically the biggest jump you've ever made away. There was no sports in it whatsoever. I think the word sports appears once. Okay.
It was in the last paragraph.
Yeah, okay, it was in the last paragraph. Okay. So, now, wouldn't it have seemed strange to you, as a young person, to say, look at a sports columnist for a major daily who's in his 40s, who, when sports were going on, chose to write about the Oscars? That would have seemed odd to you, I bet. You probably would have thought, they don't even care about sports anymore.
Yeah, but there's specific reasons for that column.
Well,
it actually was about sports. Well, first of all, everybody's so worried about the steroid era numbers and all that stuff. And the whole point of that column was that, you know, ultimately, who cares? Either somebody's great or they're not. That was what I hoped to be the lesson in the column. The other thing is that they moved my deadline back for the ESPN Magazine column. So I have to write something that is not only a week ahead of when it comes out in the newsstands, but also lasts for another 2 weeks. So it's basically a three-week shelf life.
Okay, but let's just hypothetically again. Your point, you said, and it's not a bad argument, is that either someone's great or they're not. Could that have not been addressed through a discussion of athletes, which, one could argue, would be the principal reason people are going to ESPN as opposed to entertainment coverage?
The whole point of that column,
and I'm supporting you doing these. I like the weirdest columns you do. I like, but I'm just saying that I'm wondering. I'm just kind of trying to understand your argument on this.
I don't have an argument. I'm not. You're the one who's asking me. What am I supposed to be arguing?
Well, I'm just saying that I don't. It seems as though to me that the situation you were bemoaning about newspapers sort of happens all the time organically, and that has happened to ESPN.
Yeah, but you're insinuating that I am basically proving my own argument because I didn't care about that Oscars column I handed in. Or am I not reading that correctly?
No, what I'm saying is that
Do you think I shouldn't have written the Oscars column?
No.
So then what's your point? It sounds like you're trying to make it look bad.
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is you are saying that in a newspaper, these guys get in these positions where they quit caring or whatever, right? Okay. Now, and you're saying that...
No, I didn't say they quit caring. I'm saying the impetus has been removed for them to potentially care.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they care or not doesn't matter at some point. It's all up to them and their integrity.
But first of all, what if they felt they were doing good work? What if that some of these agent columnists, in their mind, was doing their best work because now they felt their writing was less flashy, but their information was more solid, and that they were, that, you know, like, it was really interesting when I was at the Beacon Journal kind of seeing how, like, Terry Pluto's columns changed over time. And although I would think he would feel he's doing his best work ever now, you know? Now, it could have been the same for these guys, right? That they could have felt like they were doing good work. You saw it differently because you wanted something different from a column.
It's not what I see or what I don't see. It's like if they were selling newspapers, they would be selling newspapers. Isn't it their job to sell newspapers? Or you're saying it's not?
Is it their job to sell newspapers?
Who is supposed to sell newspapers at a newspaper? In my opinion, the columnist.
That's a valid argument, although I think that question takes on a much different context now, where in the past, when there really wasn't anything doing what newspapers were doing except themselves, like there wasn't these other sources, the idea was that information sold the newspaper, that people's desire for information sold the product.
But now you can get information on the internet.
Yeah, now that has been taken away, it probably is closer to what you said. I mean, you know, it would be like, how do you think your career would have been if you would have stuck with newspapers? Like, what do you think your life would have been like?
It probably would be smoking. I don't know. The thing I like about the internet is that I could take more chances than maybe you would a newspaper, like that Oscar column you mentioned.
Absolutely.
My whole thing
is... There wasn't a magazine, though, didn't it?
Yeah, that was a magazine column. But my whole thing is, like, I have the why the F not policy for columns. Like, why, if it's something that nobody's written about and it's interesting to me, then why not write it? And it seems like with your stuff, you kind of feel the same way with a lot of stuff that you've
written. Totally, yeah.
I try not to think like other people. I don't want a column to be conventional. I don't want to write about stuff that other people are writing about.
Yeah, I mean, and I did, if it did come off that I'm not criticizing it. I was just the one I remembered as being something that I feel like an average person could not get away with.
In what sense?
Yeah. Well, I think that the average guy, if some of the other writers I know at ESPN, I think if they turned in a column about the Oscars, it would have either been killed or buried. But it's not, because you're in a different position. Your track record puts you in a different position.
On page
two. But
that's
very similar to what happens with a Metro columnist who becomes very established, that the meaning of what they write changes because people already have an understanding of the writer himself or herself.
Yeah, but isn't that a strength of – that means you've done something good with your career, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, it's a good thing. But I'm just saying that from the perspective of someone who is younger, who might look up at you and look at your job as his ultimate goal, the dream he wants, it probably seems more impossible than the way the Boston Globe looked to you.
I don't agree.
I could be wrong.
I don't agree because I looked at the landscape of the Globe and my whole thing was like, all right, these guys, and the Herald too, like these guys potentially could still be writing this column in their 60s. And they can only afford to hire three or four columnists. So what are the possibilities of me actually getting a column someday here? And I decided the prospects were very, very, very low.
Well, you made the right choice.
Yeah, but not really. I mean, I quit. I bartended for a year. Like, I never thought I was going to write again.
I don't know how that happened.
I was lucky.
You have the new Morrissey record, by the way?
No.
New Morrissey record is great. There's a song on it called All You Need Is Me. And he just talked about at one point how he was like this little fat kid in a welfare house. And he just had one dream, he said, and he's like, and like fate gave it to him. And I think sometimes that might just be all it is, you know. When you try to figure out why things work out, I hate to admit that chance is probably plays the biggest role.
It was kind of outliers. Well, in my case, actually, I wish I had been 3 years younger, because I felt like I was ready in like 1999, but the internet wasn't really ready until 2001, if that makes sense.
Oh,
I had like two kind of lost years.
Well, that's true. I mean, what would have been the best era to have been a writer? You know, I think the 70s probably.
70s would be the best.
I just feel like that was probably a time when that it just would have seemed like from the perspective of how people interacted with the work and how you could live as a writer and things like that, I think that would have been the best time.
Well, the whole thing, the way newspapers, here's another example, like, yeah, they send people to go cover a boxing match in Vegas. Like, it's going to cost like, you know, $1,200, $1,500, and you're sending somebody who's writing the same kind of story they just could have bought from the AP for $25. That was just, they just didn't think things through for whatever reason. And then when it finally got to the point where it's like, oh, we're losing money, what do we do? You know, that was the first thing they stopped. All right, maybe we don't have to send these guys here or there or wherever. Maybe we should cut down on that part of it. So it was a lot of like their own, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, this happened certainly within the last 10 years, this idea that you could be a sports writer as a TV watcher, you know, which for a long time was just assumed that if a guy watching on television did not have any insights, then that makes no sense.
See, I think people are going to emulate bloggers and not somebody like me. I just think that's the way. It's easier to get an audience if you have a blog and you can get people right away to it.
Well, because you have the benefit of the commentators doing a great deal of the work. But all you're really doing is introducing ideas. When the people who are really into the internet are really into commentator culture, almost more so than the content of blogs.
Yeah.
You know, and that's seemed to me that's something that. I, you know, I don't know. I think that there's just a certain kind of person who is really, really intrigued by how people respond to their work, and a different kind of person who cares less.
Well, what's interesting to me with the blogs, and admittedly, I don't really go to them. I just try to avoid them just because I just like reading. I like reading newspapers. And I like reading books, and I just think you only have so many hours in a day you can actually read before your eyes glaze over. But the one thing that's intrigued me, and I've seen a couple times, they'll just throw stories up, and they won't even really have an angle on it, but they know it's a story that people will commentate on.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it happen. Like, I'll have, like, a friend, like, hey, did you see what so-and-so blog wrote about you today? And I'll go to it. And it's like, really? That's a post? You spent 20 minutes on that?
It's like the meritocracy thing we were talking about. It's what the meritocracy is based on, the amount of eyes you can earn or pull in, and that's mostly based on what you write about as opposed to what you actually have written.
Or what you think people will read, not what you actually want to write about.
Well, I mean, there's always these, it's like there's so many tricks to this now. It's sort of like I'll go on the New York Times website, and they'll have the little columns on the corner that'll be like, most read stories. And I will see that the number one story is like some Maureen Dowd column or something. I don't usually read Maureen Dowd, but I'll be like, well, everyone's reading this, so I'll click on it, instantly realize that I have no interest whatsoever, and leave. But I'm the reason that's the number one most read story. Because I saw it, clicked on it, spent 2 seconds and went back, but it still counts as a click. And that's how these things perpetuate themselves. I mean, more than any other place, popular things on the internet become more popular. Like popularity is its own sort of inertia.
You know what's funny when that works like that? A Streak for the Cash.
A what?
You ever play Streak for the Cash on ESPN.com?
No, what's that?
It's this game where you pick something every day and you try to get a streak going. It's kind of fun, actually.
Huh.
I like it just because I have a gambling problem. But there'll be days like a Monday where there'll be I always just pick NBA games and try to see how many in a row I can get. But there'll be some games on like a Monday where they don't have an NBA game. And I'll look at the college games and like 98% of the people will have picked Texas A&M. So I'll say, oh yeah, that sounds good. But really it's like probably five people picked them and then the other people piled on the Texas A&M. You're basically just trusting these other people who piled on to the people before them.
Well, I know. That's exactly what I mean. I mean, it's sort of the idea of the populist taste being the most important thing, that's totally true now. There used to be always sort of this war between, what do the people like and what do the pundits like and the critics like and the elite or whatever. There was this sort of this disconnect between the average person is interested in, and what these people are saying is legitimately interesting. But that war is over, and the populace has won. And that's what drives, media now.
Well, I still think with the newspapers, like a big issue with them is, like you said, you're a big newspaper, you learned a lot, but ultimately you left.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a lot of people just left. Tony Kornheiser's another example. He was a New York Times, Sports Illustrated feature writer, got a column at the Washington Post, and ultimately he went to do TV.
I know. Well, that happens, and it's rarer and rarer to see guys who don't make that transfer.
It seems like people use newspapers or have been for the last 10 years, 12 years, using newspapers as a stepping ground of sorts. So the people that end up staying are almost like the people who couldn't use it as a stepping stone. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it really was like when there was suddenly this realization that sports writers could be on TV, it suddenly became clear how, for many guys, that was their dream.
And in a weird way.
And pretty much with the very few exceptions, I guess like Frank DeFord might be one, a few others, almost everybody who made that transfer over, their writing career essentially ended. I mean, in terms of what doing important writing, that just all seemed to stop.
I was amazed by, and I saw this happen in Boston all the time, the number of beat writers who were supposed to be covering the team for their newspapers who suddenly had time to just be on a radio show from 2 to 6.
I
thought you were supposed to be a practice. I thought you were supposed to be writing a story.
Yeah, what were those 14-hour workdays I was talking about? I guess that's a good proof that I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if it was a 4-hour workday. How do you have time to just go on a show for 4 hours? I would be on shows when I was doing Sean McDonough's show where stories would be breaking, and during commercials, the guys would have to go outside and get info, and then it was basically like, oh yeah, I'll write it at 6:15. Now the first deadline for a newspaper was like 7:30.
Uh-huh.
So they basically had an hour to write their story, but they didn't care because they're getting $300 to appear on Sean McDonough's show.
I know.
So I think it's that kind of laziness that I think really played a part of what's happened, in my opinion.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, I think that I was actually doing probably exactly what I say people like to do, which is sort of romanticize the idea of what newspapers are supposed to mean without really looking at the way they actually operate.
Yeah, it was a little weird. Anything else we have to cover?
I don't know. We went long today.
Yeah, we do go long.
Yeah.
What are we going to cover next time?
I don't know. It depends when we do it again.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe I
was not criticizing that Oscar call. I was just using it.
Well, you kind of did criticize it.
Well,
though.
I apologize.
You criticized my box, too.
No, I just pointed out that the box exists, that the box is there.
But here's the thing. In 6 months, it might not. I might just get canned. And believe me, I don't, you know, it's not something like I wish I could sign a 20-year contract and have, you know, guaranteed benefits and all that stuff, but I just don't think the internet's ever going to work that way.
Well, so do you sort of have this fear that your life is going to be like Steve Martin in The Jerk? That you're going to rise all the way up and then everything will be stripped away?
I think you have this,
I worry about that all the time.
I think you have this fear. I think, you know, who knows? A year from now, what if I get hit by a rock? Ned, what if I have some sort of minor head injury? What if, I don't know, a lot of weird stuff could happen.
That's true.
It's a little frightening.
Rocks do fall, gravity.
Rocks do fall. What if I get hit by an icicle?
Well, you live in L.A., though, so.
What if an earthquake, a book hits me? Something like that.
What if this hobo we do our book reading with attacks you and kills you?
Yeah, that's true. We got to find out who the hobo is. All right, Chuck Klosterman, thanks for hanging around so long.
No problem, man.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
And that concludes another episode of the BS Report. And here's 55 more words that Bill Simmons intended to mention, but unfortunately ran out of time. Now you can get any regular pile-high Subway footlong for just $5. The keyword is any. The sweet onion chicken teriyaki, savory chicken and bacon ranch, the meaty taste bud pleasing Italian BMT. All the regular famous Subway footlongs, just $5. Subway, eat fresh. See store for details.